Well, that's a nice bang for the start of the tape.
Whoops.
Okay. So yesterday I talked about this idea that in L4 there is an operation called map, and it maps 2 to the k pages naturally aligned. Now, I have 2 theories about how this particular design came about. One is that in certain respects it's very, very elegant. And I'm absolutely certain, I never asked him, but I'm absolutely certain that Yohan Leakey was well aware of that. But the other is, it's something you can express using clever bit twiddling. And Yohan was inordinately fond of clever bit twiddling. So I want to point something out about this. That it turns out that the thing you want to send can always be expressed in a single word, where what I mean by word is something the width of the machine address, which might or might not be the natural integer size in your compiler. So the reason is that if you think about what I'm sending here, the natural alignment rule means that the address is always going to take the form of significant bits, right, up at the top, and don't cares down at the bottom, right? Why don't cares? Because if it's 2 to the k pages and a page is a power of 2, then the unit of size that we're sending must be a power of 2. And if that unit is required to be naturally aligned, then there must be some dividing point in the address. And above that dividing point is the index, effectively. And below that dividing point, we're just sending the whole unit. So these upper bits should be thought of. The way to think about this is if I'm sending a unit of 2 to the k pages, that my virtual address space is split into some number of units of size 2 to the k. Right? Just like it's split into some number of units of pages. Okay. And these upper bits are the index. Okay. Now the tricky part about this is the way this specification works, this dividing line between the index bits and the don't care bits can move back and forth to the left or to the right. However, the specification also sets to multiple pages. Okay. That means that this dividing line can only move down to a certain floor, namely the page size. And now the question is, it turns out there's a really nice way to encode this, which is to ask, how many don't care bits are there? That's the thing I really need to know. Okay. And it turns out that if the word size is 2 to the w, that means that any value that would be a legal value of bit position, right? That value has to be in the range. Between 0 and w. Right, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to encode the bit position where this offset appears, either from the left or from the right. That's going to be based on how you optimize the code. Now, here's the interesting part about that. The page size, right, is 2 to the PS for some PS. And this index position, we're going to encode that in binary form, right? And that binary form is certainly not going to occupy any more than the log base 2 of w. Because if W is the biggest value and we're going to base 2 encode it, it's going to be encoded in something that fits in log 2 of WBits. Rounded up to the nearest integer, of course. You don't get encoded in semi-bits. If you figure out how to do that, you know, let the world know. I patented first. Now, here's the wacky part. It turns out that there are no arcs. So how many bits do I have to put this in? Well, I know that there's a floor on how far this line can move, and that means that there's some bits down the bottom that I know in advance have to be don't cares. They can't possibly be anything else. It turns out on every machine that we now know about, that number of bits is always going to be enough to encode this index. So the way you encode this thing is, in practice, that you take that effectively pointer value and you put your flex page dividing line wherever it is you put it, that above this dividing line is the flex page index, below this line is your don't cares, down to the page size boundary, and then in the bits below where the page size boundary is, you encode the flex page exponent, which tells you where this line is. Okay. And you'll find, if you go through the L4 manual, that things like, and these sort of low-level representation tricks are everywhere. This is brilliant if your goal is maximally dense encoding. In fact, not only are these bit twiddling tricks everywhere, but having done these bit twiddling tricks, you'll then discover that these values, like the FP exponent, in some cases are biased. They're off by one or off by something. And the reason they're biased is because Johann knew that there were hardware machines that provided certain instructions where they were commonly available, where if you built in the bias in the right way, you'd be able to save a couple of instructions in the path. Now, this is a level of micro-optimization that I personally think is ridiculous. Because in this particular example, it turns out that this is likely to work for all 64-bit address spaces. I'm not so convinced that it's going to work for 128-bit address spaces, right? There's some size where this is going to stop working. But at some point, you're going to say, hey, you know, I might want to be able to describe things other than flex pages. And Johann might respond, good, but anything you want to describe other than flex pages could be described by breaking it down into a sequence of things that are flex pages. And in fact, I've left something out. I've said that it maps a 2 to the k page thing that's naturally aligned. I've skipped something. In fact, you specify one of these things and you could give a count. So you can say, I want things that are 16 page aligned and I want to send a string of 4 of those in sequence. And so there's some interesting flexibility that's driven by need for alignment in this. Yeah.
Over there, I is the boundary between the flex page index and the...
Okay, so I is what I've called the flex page exponent, which, by the way, is not what Johann called it. I don't remember what term he used. But essentially, it's a count of that number of bits between the flex page divider and 0.
Okay. And log base 2 of W, C then?
Of W. This is not a 7. That's a ceiling. Right, so the question is, if I want to encode this value that describes where the flex page boundary is, what's the largest value that this could undertake? And the answer is, well, it's the word size, right? Because there aren't any more bits up this way. And the next question is, how many bits do I need to encode the word size? Well, I'm going to encode it as a power of 2. So the number of bits that I need to encode it as a power of 2 is whatever the maximum value is, right? Take log base 2 of that and round up. Strictly speaking, we got to be a little bit careful, because if the value that we're encoding is exactly the power of 2, then we have to ask whether we're going to be 0 relative or 1 relative.
Right.
If I've got to encode the value 4, and I also have to encode the value 0, 2 bits won't do it. I need 3. So strictly speaking, if W is the word size, this should be W minus 1. This is the sort of zero relative or one relative indexing issue we keep running into in computer science because we can't make up our minds. Okay, so I wanted you to see this just because this was actually very, very clever. And it's one of the few cases I've seen where clever actually isn't a four-letter word. The other thing I want to say about it, and this is actually a really positive thing about it, is it turns out, lo and behold, if you're sharing a mapping, almost always the unit that you want to share is a power of 2. Or if it's not, it can be viewed as held inside some power of 2 container in your virtual address space. Why? Well, because it's actually a lot easier for you as a programmer to manage your mappings if you put them in power of 2 boundaries anyway. So the idea that I could point to an arbitrary power of 2 and say, send this portion of my address space, provided it's aligned in the right way, is actually a very powerful and useful idea. And the node tree can't do that. So let me go back to the node tree. Right? It's a hierarchy, it's a hierarchical substructure in which the natural units of transmission, if I want to share a structure, are where the capabilities appear in the hierarchy. And because of the width of a node, right? So the way to think about a node tree is, just like you have a binary tree, you can have a 3-area tree, you can have a 4-area tree, right? This is a 32-area tree. That's right. So it's a tree where the node arity is 32, or the node width, or the node span, if you prefer. So the units that are natural to send in this system are units of 32 to the k pages, because it's a 32-area tree. You're looking puzzled. Okay. And that turns out to be bloody inconvenient. Yep, pretty often that I want to send a page, but if I'm on a 4K page system, 128 kilobytes just isn't real good for anything. It's too big for small objects, and it's in practice too small for big objects. But my next choice is 4 megabytes. And my choice after that is 128 megabytes, which is too big again. So when we did the window manager for Eros, it turns out 4 megabytes is too small, right? On a full color display, that's not enough to describe the full display. 128 megabytes is considerably bigger than you need. And if what you're trying to do is give a full display bitmap to each client, which we were trying to do for various reasons, right? Then what you have to do is you basically want to map multiple memory windows in the window system and essentially copy those bits to the display on demand. Well, those windows each take up a region of your address space, and in the Eros scheme, the only natural regions, the smallest natural region that was big enough was this 128 megabyte region. And that was a nuisance. Because, by the way, it turned out that the matching number we needed was like 8 megabytes.
Where is this node tree used? You said this was in Xen?
No, this is in Eros. And you know what? I just said the wrong thing. It's not 128 megabytes either.
The magic number we needed was 256. I think it was 256 megabytes. Now, this is the arrow structure I'm describing. Zen does something different, and maybe I should talk about that, but let me not do it today. Zen does something that they did something in their first version that was very, very clever, but it turned out not to be very adaptable, and they've since had to change it. And the change is pushing it actually very much more in the direction of nodes, except that they've used the hardware structures. So their choices for sharing are even less flexible. And the reason that's okay is that they don't ever do sharing, which is going to turn out in due course to be a performance issue for them. The second problem with this structure is, think about the address space of a normal process. Second problem with the node structure. Right, here's my address space. It's got some empty stuff down at the bottom. In particular, you want page 0 to be empty. You'd really like to take a page fault if somebody indirects through a null pointer. That would be good. Okay. Standard trick is guaranteed that page 0 is unmapped. That'll catch most of those. It's got some text space. That's a couple of pages. Maybe more than a couple, but you know, some number of linear pages. And those are dense, right? They're adjacent. It's got a data space, and the data space is going to tend to grow upwards because the sort of long-standing tradition is that your heap goes, the initialized data comes first, uninitialized data comes second, right? And then immediately following the uninitialized data, that's where your heap traditionally starts. Now, recently, people have been playing with address space randomization, and this is not always true anymore. I predict that address space randomization is going away because it doesn't work and it's a pain in the ass. And then way up at the top of your address space, you've got a stack which, if you have any brains, is only a couple of pages because, frankly, if your stack is deeper than that, your program doesn't know what it's doing anyway. You know, a couple might be four. You know, barring some really exceptional sort of deeply recursive algorithms, and there are a few of those, but very few that are actually well motivated. Usually a really deep stack means your program is not sensibly structured. But of course, between these two things, right, there's a huge no man's land of unmatched pages. And so what ends up happening in the node structure is you end up being forced to build a tree that goes down the left of the tree. Excuse me, to insert nodes that have the effect of populating the left side of the tree. And to insert nodes that have the effect of populating the right side of the tree. Right? Then you end up with a big hole in the middle. Oh, and above your stack, by the way, right, is this kernel region, which is not part of your address space, but it does have some effect. So this path, which leads down to your stack page over on the right, you'd be tempted to think, oh, it should go in the uppermost slot of this node at the top, but actually it doesn't. It actually goes about 3/4 of the way through because the application kernel dividing line is typically set at 3 gigabytes on current systems in a 32-bit system. So this is a horrible data structure. It's a data structure that was motivated by the 360 hardware design. That was where it came from. It has the redeeming merit that it can be used for a bunch of other purposes, which is why we didn't abandon it. But it's inconvenient in the sense that its natural arities, right, force us to sharing boundaries that turn out not to be very convenient. And from a representation standpoint, it's actually not very efficient. Right? This goes back to things I said in the OS class about the utilization of page tables. I mean, if you look at a typical page table, it's got 1,000 entries, and some very small number of them are used. And the rest, they exist only to have the not valid state set. Okay. And we're not going to be able to change that for the hardware tables, but we'd like not to replicate it in the software tables. So we'd like a data structure that's a little more flexible. Second issue. There are some level skipping optimizations in Eros. So in particular, it turns out that as long as you're going through the leftmost slot of the node, and as that's the only slot that's interesting, all the other slots are invalid, you can drop that node. You can bypass it. It's a special case optimization, and it was put in because people noticed that the vast majority of these trees were heavily populated low down on the left side of the tree at low addresses. Right? And then they had a big hole, and that in particular in these mid-levels, you would discover that the only reason you had these nodes was because the zero slot was needed to get to the next node down. Does that make sense? Why that went in? Okay. And the next optimization you would have done would have been the one where you only have the top slot being significant, because that would have been the one on the path to your stack. And there have been occasions when I wished that had been done. I'm now glad that it wasn't. The reason I'm now glad that it wasn't is that I have these trusty, clever software elves in my lab that came up with a better data structure about 2 years ago. Year and a half ago? Something like that. We're still sort of working on implementing it. So here's the idea. What we would like, first, we'd like a structure that isn't quite so rigid. Right. Second, we'd like a structure in which we get to say what the natural sharing boundaries are. We're not going to be able to do that perfectly. There are really well-motivated reasons to stick to powers of two. But we'd like to be able to choose an arbitrary power of two, not be stuck at a 32 to the k power of two, which are indeed powers of two, but they're damn awkward powers of two. And we'd like to deal with this observation that address spaces are actually sparse. And what I mean by that is if you look at the structure of a real program, what you're going to discover is at the bottom, where you actually have populated pages in an address space, you tend to have them clumped very densely. Your code, right, you don't spread it around. It's sequential. Your data, the same way. People are playing games randomly allocating the heap. It may be a necessary evil, but it's probably not a good idea. Your stack is certainly dense, right? The hardware would get really, really confused if it returned from a procedure and discovered that your stack had gone missing. So it's dense at the bottom, but you know, it's dense in units of about 128 megabytes or less, typically. If you go look at a typical binary, you peel it apart and you ask, how big is the code? Then with the exception of anything that uses X windows, you're going to discover it's tiny. Right? And nowadays, with dynamic linking, at least for X windows, you only carry the code once. Which is good, because that means there's only one place to fix it. And so we'd sort of like something that lets us exploit this property of dense at the bottom, you know, and sparse in the upper structure. Okay. So Jochen, who is the person who came up with the flex page idea, had proposed something he called a guarded page table. Now, a guarded page table can be viewed, this is not how it was invented, but you can think of it as a generalization of this zero slot trick. So it says, if you have a path from someplace above to someplace down below, any place, right? But that's the only path that's valid in that particular subtree, right? Then for that path, right, there's some number of bits that describes the path, and if we simply recorded what those bits were, we wouldn't need all these extra data structures. So that's the guard in the guarded page table. If you think about this as a graph structure problem, The nature of a guarded page table is it's a link between a dense page table and another dense page table. The upper one here is intended to be, I should explain a term. I do not like the term page directory, right? Intel created this page directory page table distinction. It's a terrible idea because there's no magic reason to think that your hierarchy should be of height 2. Right? What do you call the third level? What do you call a fourth level? You're going to run out of terms, right? These are all page tables. They're just page tables at different levels in the tree. Okay. So what the guarded page table thing does is it says, hey, first, we don't have to predefine the number of levels. We can actually design hardware that can traverse a more flexible data structure than that. But think of this upper dense PT as an upper level page table, and the lower dense PT as a lower level page table. And what we're trying to achieve here is better utilization of memory. We're not going to do better, probably, than the number of memory references in the hardware for a conventional page table structure. For a 32-bit machine. For a 64-bit machine, by the way, simply to reduce the number of memory references, this design actually becomes very interesting. Because hierarchies, there are just too many bits to traverse. Inflexible hierarchies just aren't very good at that. But if you think about this as a graph problem, the question is now, where do I store the guard? Because I can't put it in the arrow. The arrow doesn't have a direct representation, right? The arrow is really some bits that are sitting in a slot in the upper page table. And there are two essentially equivalent representations that you can use to capture this data structure. One is to say, well, I will always put the guard at the beginning of the pointer. What I'll do is I will change the format of my page table entry so that in addition to a pointer to the next page table and a set of permissions, it has a guard field. And since I'm Yuffin and I'm a really, really clever bit twiddler, I will come up with a very clever formulation for this that will minimize the number of bits required. And I did. And that's the design you chose. However, to the best of my knowledge, this data structure was never used in production. It was used experimentally in one version of L4 for a particular version of the MIPS chip. And the reason it was used is the MIPS chip had a software translation scheme. Right, so it didn't have hardware-defined page tables. What happens on that machine when you page fault is the machine basically goes to software. How does it get to the software? Well, it has an entry in its TLB that's actually pinned. God help you if you manage to replace that one. You will not survive the next page fault because what you're pinning is the page fault handle. And it traverses the data structure in software. And so Yochum was looking, I mean, he actually had invented this data structure well before, but he was looking for a soft structure that would be at least as efficient as the hardware structure, and one that would be dense, because this is a kid situation where you actually care how many entries this is going to take up in your translation mechanism for the overhead structures. So it was used in the MIPS, but it wasn't used in other cases. The situation in Eros is a little different. Because in Eros, remember that this soft structure is not the one that's being watched by the TLB. It's the software definition of the mapping. And we're going to build a projection of this into the hardware structure. One of the key requirements to make the algebra of that projection work is that all of the entries in a page, it helps a lot if all of the entries in a page table translate the same number of bits. And what I mean by that is if I'm looking at a given page table and I have some valid slot, the invalid slots we don't care, some valid slot, and I traverse down to the next page table, whichever valid slot I go through, I really want it to be true that the next page table, sorry, that I've translated the same number of bits in each slot. Otherwise, I'm going to get into funny mismatches in tree height, and those are going to make tracking the dependencies from one tree to another very, very difficult. So what we chose to do
remember, I think this was Eric's edition. I think this was Eric's.
I don't know which one you're doing yet. So.
Was to move the guard to the lower hands. Right? So you can basically put the guard with the head of the arrow or with the tail of the arrow. Sorry, got that backwards. Put it with the tail of the arrow or with the head of the arrow. So GPTs, guarded page tables, put it with the tail, and Pats put it with the head, with the pointed part. So here's what a Pat structure looks like. Remember, we're doing a soft structure. We're not looking for a page table pointer in this structure. We're looking for a capability to the next soft page table structure. But that is going to serve exactly the same role as the page table pointer in the hardware structure. And that capability already has permissions in it. Yeah.
The guard over here would be the common set of bits, the set of bits that's common to the whole sparse, sorry, dense address space down below.
In the offense design, yes. In our design, no. I'm about to explain our design. Which one are you asking about?
The bits on the other side.
So in the offense, no. In the offense design, each entry in the upper page table has a different guard. Right. So it describes the path prefix that if you had actually had all those data structures in place, this would have been the only valid path.
So only if it was, if all the children of that node were not.
Let me come at it backwards. I think you're on the right trail. So here's the idea. So it turns out one of the things you can do is you can take a guarded page table and you can insert new layers such that all of the guards are now unnecessary and do not translate any bits. Okay. And the way you do that is however many bits the guard has, right, you need, suppose it has B bits. You need a page table that is 2 to the B entries wide. The only entry in that page table that is going to be valid is the one that would have been indexed by the guard value. Right? All the others are invalid. Okay. So the pointer is, hey, we notice there's only one. It turns out that's a really, really common case. Okay? And so this allows us to elude the intervening data structure. Yeah.
And if the that node were to be further populated by children, then
if it had more, the minute it has more than one valid entry, we're going to actually have to put a data structure there.
Okay.
Right. And it might be, well, either we'll have to put a data structure there, maybe we'll get lucky and we'll decide that we can maybe fatten the data structure below it. But one way or another, we're going to have to account for the fact that there are now multiple entries that we really do need to map. Either by adding a structure or by changing some existing structure. Either way, it could work, depending on which bits got changed. Okay, so I see that I should have written this differently. I'm just moving this over to the right so I have a little bit more room. So a PAT, which is the data structure I'm now describing, which stands for Prefixed Address Translation Tree, in fact, I originally called them GPTs, trying to sort of be respectful of Jochen, and one of my students correctly said, no, this is a different data structure. Don't confuse matters by giving it the same name. And that's absolutely right.
So a PAT consists of essentially a capability to the next level down. Right? Just like in the node tree, you have capabilities from one node to the next, right? And then at the bottom, you have the capability to a page. But it has a prefix pattern. Now, explain that prefix pattern.
This is why I really wanted that central section today. Here's an address we're translating. Okay. Down at the bottom, bits. It's got some bits that describe the offset of the page. We're not translating those.
And the upper bits constitute the page address. Okay? And one way to think about what's happening in a tree structure translation, right, is that we're munching bits off the top as we go. So in the traditional two-layer scheme, there's a dividing line in the middle, right? We munch off the upper bits to index the upper table, and then we munch off some more bits to index the lower table, okay? So I like to think of this as the Pac-Man translation strategy, right? It's really interesting, right? So we can now divide the group into the class into three groups. People who enjoy legacy games, right? People who grew up in countries where those games aren't legacy games yet, you know, and the rest of you. Okay, so this is like the Pac-Man translation strategy. We're going to munch bits from the top. Now, one way to think about what's happening in a guarded page table is we're going to alternate between munching bits that index a page table, okay, of some level, and munching guard bits. Okay, and depending on whether we attach the guard up or down, that's just a matter of data structure, and that will cause us to think of the guard as associating to the left or associating to the right, but it's still the same bits. It's only associating in the sense that it's going to change our algorithm structure slightly. What we need to know though, the thing we need to know, so when we get to a guard, or equivalently when we get to a prefix, they're serving precisely the same role. Well, we know that, look, simply by virtue of having gotten there, any bits above us in the address, they must be zero, have to be zero, or we can't be here because we must have already translated. The other thing we need to know is how wide is the guard or the prefix bit. How many bits does it consume? And we capture that by recording two values. The first we call R, which is for residual. What it says is, after we're done translating this guard, or this prefix, how many more bits will be left to do? The second one is called H, for height. If we were to describe this subtree of the address space as a binary tree, how tall would the tree be? That is, how many valid bits remain in the address to be translated? And of course, the width of the guard is H minus R. Now, here we get to a difference between the GPT structure and the patch structure. In the GPT structure, each of these entries can have its own answer for those values. Right? It's a flexibly weighted tree. And that's, in abstract, a good thing. But for our purposes, the Arrows translation tree, that actually would be quite helpful. So, in the, and in fact, as we discovered this part, so in the patch structure, all patterns are required to have the same values for H and R. And in fact, as a matter of representation, that in a well-formed data structure of this kind, all of the bits from R down are required to be zero. I'm just making this part of the specification of the data structure. You'll see why I said that. And all of the bits, if any, exist above H are required to be zero. Now I want you to think about the address. Let me just make myself a little room here that we are going to compare this against. So that address has some upper zeros because those are the bits we've already transmitted, right? Because Pac-Man was hungry. Okay. It has some bits that correspond to the pattern position. And it's going to have some bits that, when we're all done, are going to be address bits, but for now they're residual bits. And what we need to do in order to do this comparison, we need a way to mask out these low bits. There are two ways to do it. One is we can just take both of them and shift them down.
That'll get rid of the bits. Get rid of those pesky bits. I hate these pesky bits.
Okay. But the alternative, which turns out to be less expensive computationally, is we can use R essentially to compute a mask. And we can mask the low bits out. Notice then that all we have to do is the quality comparison. Okay, so we're going to mask everything from R down. We're going to make a temporary copy of the address. We're just going to mask that up. Now, here we get to the other cube part. So the way we originally specified it, this prefix was not per entry. It was attached to the table header like the H and R values were. It was quite literally simply that we chose to move the guard down rather than up, and it had to do with this issue that we wanted the same number of bits translated in every slot, and that favored moving the guard in a particular direction for our purposes. So what Eric noticed is, hey, we should put the prefix on every entry. And we should make this data structure fully associative. But this is actually a pretty radical move. In conventional structures of this nature, right, that's been the given wisdom for forever, right, that the right strategy is index and go. The reason the right strategy is index and go is in several parts. One, hardware is good at that. Two, it minimizes the number of memory references you're going to do, and that matters. Memory references really hurt, and they're hurting more and more and more and more. And three, you don't have any spare computational power. Right? At the time that page tables were developed, it was a good thing if you got one integer operation per cycle. In fact, none of the machines got that. So doing a lot of them was not something you wanted to do in the middle of your translation path. Now, and caches were small. The situation today is a little different. Memory hurts a lot more. But if you're going to memory, you're going to get a cache line. And cache lines are pretty big. You can't do less than that. And you've got more integer operations than you can throw a processor at. They're free. As long as you go in a straight line, okay? This is like the Ferrari. You know the story about the Ferrari brakes? You know the story because I told you this story. So a customer once complained to Enzo Ferrari about the lousy brakes on the Ferrari, and Enzo says, I built cars to go, not to stop. Okay? Processors are like that too. As long as you don't do a branch and you go in a straight line, man, the processor is your friend. You take a left turn and you are just going to hurt. Okay? But, last observation. No, not last observation. If you put this pattern at the top of the page table, then what you've done is you've dealt with this problem of intermediate levels, but you actually haven't really dealt with this issue of sparsity. Because you're still in this indexing orientation. It's the indexing that forced you to have lots of invalid entries. And the only reason those invalid entries were there was to chew up indexing space that you could not otherwise get rid of. Now, Eric looks at this picture. He says, Jack, you goofball. This is just a picture. This isn't
what's really going on. There's two ways to arrange this data structure. So for the sake of the table, I'm essentially filling in the table to show more entries. You can think of this table as an array the way it's drawn, where each row consists of a pair, if you're a schmuck. Eric did not say that part. He thought it, most likely, but he did not actually say it. Or you can think of it as two vectors that are positionally correlated. So entry 0 in the pattern vector describes the pattern for entry 0 in the capability vector. Why would you want to do this? Because if you do this, the entire vector of patterns will sit in a single cache line. And you can't fetch less than that. And at this point, I gotta tell you, I'm still thinking a fully associative data structure is somewhere between idiocy and lunacy, and I can't decide which. I was down on this idea. It's a good idea. I was wrong. I said, but Eric, now I gotta search this thing. You know, it's really hard to beat the performance of a barrel shifter. Yes, Intel screwed up the barrel shifter on the P4, but this error does not generalize. It's one of these mistakes that crops up in processors about every 20 years, and then people remember that this was a really dumb thing to screw up, and then they don't do it again. Eric says, aha, yes, but we now have these things called integer pipelines. We have lots of integer units, and we can do lots of operations at once, as long as we go in a straight line. So once we've fetched the data, we might as well check all of it. And what he proposes is essentially that we should run a loop which we're going to fully unroll. Right? So we're not actually going to run the loop. Right? This is a loop that's going to run a constant number of times, 8 or 16, something like that, depending on how many slots there are in a path. We're just going to do it sequentially. And that loop is going to take the form of, we have a constant we're comparing against, which is the mask address, load, compare, conditional move, load, compare, conditional move. No branches. The goal of the conditional move is to figure out which index position matches. And as of yesterday afternoon, we now know that yes, his hypothesis was almost correct and definitely close enough, that the cost of doing 16 compares, as long as you can linearize them in this particular memory layout, is really, really close. It's just a few cycles more expensive than the cost of index and go. I gotta tell you, this surprises the hell out of me.
But it is. Now that's actually beautiful, because that means that all of these intermediate layers that existed only to have one path through them that we could not conveniently describe. Because it turns out, yeah, you use the zero slot a lot, but there's always some path that somehow doesn't go through the zero, even though there's only one path.
But this is, at the top sparse part, right, this is the ideal data structure. Right. It's really good at saying, I have a huge space, it's the number described by the bits in the pattern, of which only some small number of slots are active. And at the bottom, it's a mostly good data structure. Right? At the bottom, I'm actually not likely to use the patterns because I'm likely to have dense allocation. But in terms of space, these patterns aren't costing me very much. Well worth it. Total space usage in this data structure is significantly less than the space usage was for nodes. Now here's the really cool part. It turns out, in a microkernel system that's well designed, you have a lot of really, really small processes. These processes may only have 8 or 16 pages. And they can be described with one of these. All right, let me leave you with that thought. This is what I wanted to get through today. I will talk a little bit on Monday about Zen. I will send to the mailing list information about the midterm, including dates. Subject matter of the midterm is the readings that are on the syllabus up to this point, not counting that horrible brain death comment that you so enjoyed, or the code path, which is also not covered. And I will try to assemble a node quickly.
going through these three designs so that you have a sort of a reference for it. And I will get the recordings online for all the classes that we've recorded so that you are able to review them. And I'll get you a date. Yeah.
I don't think we have class on Monday.
Oh, you're right. It's a holiday Monday. Right. So obviously, if I talk about that Monday, I'll be very lonely. Okay. But we'll talk about that next week. Provisionally, my intention, unless it conflicts with a holiday for some of our students, my intention is to do the midterm on Wednesday. If it conflicts, I'll defer it another week. This is not going to be a big deal for reasons I've already told. Okay. Anything else?